Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series on the hidden hands, the power behind the scenes. We're going to talk about the humanitarian crisis in the U.S., U.K., Saudi-led war in Yemen, and Trump escalation of the conflict with U.S. Special Forces on the ground. My guest talking, I believe she's in France right now, is Vanessa Beely. Vanessa is a British investigative journalist who is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Gaza and Syria. She is an associate editor of 21st Century Wire and was a member of the peace-finding mission to Syria and organized by the U.S. Peace Council. Unlike so many American pundits and so-called foreign policy experts who give us their insight, almost always extremely biased towards a military presence in the countries, regime change in virtually all the countries we're targeting, and no qualms about what this means to the people living in those countries, but they've never actually been there in a conflict zone and spoken with all the people. Well, Vanessa has. She was in Aleppo during and after its liberation, and after the city was in the hands of the terrorists for almost 5 years, the Salafist terrorist organization. She is credited with having exposed the fraud behind the faux charitable volunteer organization, the alleged Syrian Civil Defense, or better known as the White Helmets, which won an Academy Award just recently. She is also a contributing writer to the global campaign to return to Palestine, the dissident voice, and manages the website The Wall Will Fall from London, where she blogs about her travels and reports from the Middle East. Her websites are thewallwillfall.org and 21stcenturywire.com. Nice to have you with us, Vanessa.
Hi, nice to be back on.
Vanessa, unlike our other panelists who have each contributed an hour insight, who are former top CIA officials and analysts and people engaged in espionage or the analysis of espionage, that is not your role. Your role is to show us the consequences of this hidden group of power people, whatever you wish to call them. If you wish to call them the deep state, if you wish to call them the other, or in this case, we're calling it the hidden hands. People who are not accountable to anyone. People who seem to be not just a fourth column, but a fifth column. They have enormous control over foreign and domestic policy. They work with virtual impunity. They have unlimited funds at their disposal. And what we do not know is how they've managed to do this, and do they have enough information on people in Congress to blackmail them or to influence them? So one day we wake up and we find out that, well, they're weapons of mass destruction, and the next thing we might see would be a mushroom cloud, and there's a missile that can get to the United States in a matter of minutes, none of which is true. And a diligent media, paying attention to inspectors who have been on the ground, like Mr. Blix and others, would have known that. Or possibly they did know that, because what John Pilger has shown us brilliantly is that almost all the people who went to war as journalists went as embedded journalists, meaning they were there to promote the war. And when I started listening to his documentary, which will be playing in the next week or two, you hear the journalists bragging about their favorite weapon, their favorite jet, their favorite type of black op operation. They're not supposed to be there being cheerleaders for the war. They're supposed to be there representing the American public on telling the truth whether or not this war is necessary, how it's being executed, and the consequences of it. None of that was done. I have to ask, how could you have involved that many people unless you were more powerful than the people that you were involving? That meant more powerful than Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, George Tenet, head of the CIA, Wolfowitz, and a whole group of other people in state and national defense agencies. Similarly, I believe that these are the same people who got us into Vietnam, Remember the Gulf of Tonkin? It was completely fictitious. It never happened. And remember what the press was saying? If we don't get them over there, there'll be a domino effect and they'll be here. 3 million people died because of that lie. Who had that much power to cause President Johnson, and before him Kennedy, to say we will be there? When we look at going into Libya, Libya was considered the Paris of Africa. Of the 54 countries in Africa, it was the most advanced in its literacy rate, 84%. And its freedom for women, it had more freedom for Muslim women than any other Muslim country in the world. It had more democracy in place with local councils, thousands of them, making decisions that had the power to even override Gaddafi. They shared in the wealth of the country. Irrespective of Gaddafi and his ego or his kleptocracy, what you have is you have a country that was thriving, the largest water project, private water project, irrigation project in the world, and the best education in Africa, and free health care, and plus all these other bonuses for being married, having a home or a farm. We don't have any of that in the United States. They had it there. They were not a threat, real or existential, yet someone had the power to say, we need to regime change there. The front people were Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Who told them they had the right and should do that? The same in Syria. So the difference is where our other panelists have told us about who these people are, what influence they have, like Danny Sheehan gave us a meticulous description of where they have been for almost 100 years, who they are, their companies, what corporations they represent, and what their ultimate goals are. You're responsible, if you would please, to do something no other American journalist has done. Tell us the truth, having been there. Because as soon as Trump entered the White House at the end of January, the U.S. commandos were immediately deployed to Yemen on the ground. There was the Navy SEAL whose widow was honored by Trump at his recent speech before Congress last week. Then also the U.S. carried out about 30 airstrikes on supposed al-Qaeda or known as AQAP targets. However, U.S. military involvement goes back much further. Back when Obama started drone strikes on al-Qaeda targets back in 2009. And it's been the last 2 years when the conflict has been especially brutal and now resulting in a virtual humanitarian crisis with over 25 million Yemeni civilians starving or on the brink of starvation. And our mainstream media is almost virtually silent. Certainly, if it reports, it never ascribes responsibility. The average American is clueless about Yemen, including the numerous aerial and drone strikes and bombing campaigns conducted by the Saudi military, as well as the devastation and carnage and civilian deaths. And only when a drone strike goes awry and civilians or children are victims does the sideline blurb appear in the news, and the average American is unaware of its significance. I'd like you to begin, please, by taking us through the main time frame of the Yemeni war, especially during the last 2 to 3 years, the Saudi government and its military involvement, and also in your answer, please distinguish and make sense of the two seemingly different conflicts currently being waged. First, the war against al-Qaeda or the AQAP, and then second, the war against the Yemeni Houthis, who are Shia, and who the U.S. claims are being supplied with weapons and funds by Iran, and also who would have the power to do this? Who benefits? Why would we commit so much of our military and intelligence and satellite expertise unless there was another agenda that we have not been told about? And hopefully in your discussion, we can at least see how that is possible. And finally, I recently saw a list of all the targets, and not one of these targets represent a military targets. These are infrastructures where schools and water purification plants, electric plants, and hospitals and food supply depots were bombed repeatedly. This is in complete contravention to at least 3 separate international treaties, and this represents war crimes against both Saudi Arabia and the other participants, and yet not a word about this in the mainstream or alternative media. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. I think it is very important to give the background, as you described, to this Saudi coalition war of aggression that is being waged against 27 million Yemeni people that was or could not have taken place, of course, without President Obama's endorsement of that war of aggression. I think what we should do is maybe go back to 2011, when there was yet another one of these manipulated, manufactured, prefabricated, let's say, Arab Springs, to remove President Ali Abdullah Saleh and to replace him with what was effectively a puppet regime headed up by President Mansour Hadi, who was very clearly not only a puppet to the Saudi regime, but also to, obviously, to the United States government, who for whom Saudi Arabia is a very clear ally in the region. At that time, with the imposition of Mansour Hadi, it was clear from the objectives of the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC initiative, that Hadi's mission was to basically issue in the next 2 years of his rule, so from 2012 until 2014 were the 2 years that he was given in his presidency, to basically draw up a draft constitution and to hold general elections within that two-year mandate. And what happened was we arrived at January the 21st, 2014, when Hadi's tenure had basically run out. At that point, the GCC initiative members decided to extend, basically illegitimately, Hadi's presidency for a further 1 year. In January 2015, having gone through an extended period of presidency, during which time he had still failed to produce the constitution that had been demanded of him back in 2012, and he had also failed to call the elections. On January the 22nd, 2015, he resigned his post as president. And he did not withdraw that resignation, despite various calls for him to do so. He then left Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, for Aden, on a port on the southern coast of Yemen, from where he had pressure put upon him by the Saudi regime to take back up the cudgels of his presidency. So he then attempted to move the government from Sana'a to Aden, at which point the various united Yemeni forces moved against him in Aden in protest against this usurping of power, basically. And at that point, he fled to Riyadh. And from then on, he basically called upon Saudi Arabia to bomb his own people to reinstate him. So we have here immediately a situation where we have an illegitimate president, according to the majority of analysts inside Yemen, a fugitive president who fled his own country to the Saudi state, where he called upon the Saudi coalition to bomb his own people. And the other very important point to make, and a lot of people are completely unaware of this, but following Hadi's fleeing his own country, based upon national dialogue outcomes and a peace and national partnership agreement that included all Yemeni parties and factions, the Yemeni people were on their way to a political solution just after Hadi having left the country. And actually, the UN peace envoy at the time made the very clear statement, and I'll quote it here. When this campaign started, meaning the Saudi coalition bombing campaign, one thing that was significant but went unnoticed is that the Yemenis were close to a deal that would institute power sharing with all sides, including Houthis. So this is a very important two points to make. One, the president that is being flaunted by the international community, led by the United States and particularly the UK, they are flaunting this president to be the legitimate president of Yemen, and yet he has clearly, one, resigned his position, two, a replacement government was put into power after he had left, a legitimate government underneath the Yemeni constitution. And all of those procedures were ignored and completely eradicated in Western public perception. Yet again, we're seeing this, you know, erasure of facts in order to portray a certain image of a level of aggression against a sovereign nation in Western public perception. Very clearly, we've seen this across the board in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria, and certainly in Yemen. So those are very, very clear points that need to be made. Another very clear point that needs to be made, you made the point about the bombing in Yemen to supposedly curtail the activities of AQAP, Al-Qaeda Arab Peninsula. What we actually saw in the period between 2012 and 2015 was that the Yemeni forces, supported by the Houthi, as you call them, in fact, the better term for them is Ansarullah, who actually effectively make up about less than 1% of the Yemeni population, but who as Ansarullah, have grown to be a popular movement that is resisting the colonialism of Saudi Arabia and the neocolonialism by proxy of the United States and its allies in the EU. In the period between 2012 and 2015, these various resistance forces were actually on the brink of driving AQAP, Al-Qaeda, out of Yemen and centering them into a tiny port area on the south coast, Mukalla. So effectively, the Yemeni forces themselves had successfully driven Al-Qaeda into almost near oblivion until the Saudi aggression began in March 2015. And that bombing campaign immediately allowed Al-Qaeda to flourish, not only because it threw the entire country into disarray, chaos, etc., but also because there are recorded instances yet again of the Saudi coalition dropping weapons, supplies, equipment, food to the Al-Qaeda fighters and allowing them to flourish and to again proliferate all along the southern coast of Yemen. Why is the southern coast of Yemen so important? Again, this is a very clear indicator of the United States' interests in Yemen in particular. In the area of Marib and Al-Jawf, which are in the center of Yemen and to the north close to the Saudi border, there are very rich oil and gas reserves. Saudi Arabia is probably the only Gulf state that has the ability to pass an oil pipeline east to west to either the Red Sea and to the Bab el-Mandeb Straits to the west, which are controlled by the Yemenis, or to the Hormuz Straits to the east, which are controlled by, of course, their nemesis in the region, Iran. So for the Saudis to be able to transport oil from both Saudi Arabia and from Yemen, they would have to traverse these two straits. So there were some very clear indications, I believe they were leaked by WikiLeaks, showing a project to drop a pipeline from the center of Yemen down to the southern port of Mukalla. And from there, from the Gulf of Aden, the Saudi transporters would be able to come in and pick up the oil from Yemen and to transport it globally. And then that would mean that they could operate without having to go through the Iranian-held Straits of Hormuz or to navigate the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, which are controlled by Yemeni forces. So that was a major geopolitical strategy on behalf of the Saudi coalition and of its partners in the United States and in the UK. And it would also potentially explain the proliferation of the al-Qaeda forces and the reinforcing of those forces by the Saudi coalition entirely along that southern stretch of coastline of Yemen, which would secure it, one could speculate, for the pipeline to be able to drop down from Marib and Al-Jawf. Then if we look at the UN role in the destabilization of Yemen, and it's very hard often in many of these situations of illegal sovereign nation to divorce the role of the UN from the predatory nation that is intervening into a sovereign nation. And this is no different. If we go back to Iraq in 1991, we know that the UN played a very pivotal role in the subjugation of the Iraqi people, the starvation under sanctions of over 500,000 children. We are basically seeing a repeat of that operation in Yemen. Under UN Resolution 2216, which effectively imposed an embargo upon five named individuals inside Yemen. That embargo is being used by the Saudi coalition and its allies to effectively starve and blockade 27 million Yemenis. As Professor Francis Boyle noted, a very well-known professor of humanitarian law, the UN embargo or blockade against Yemen and the Yemenis violates Genocide Convention Article 2, which means deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole. But if we actually look at the level of the humanitarian crisis inside Yemen, it's absolutely harrowing and horrifying. And we have to come back to this fact that UN 2216 is also grounded in the legitimacy of President Mansour Hadi. And I have just fully explained that he is not legitimate. So the UN sanctions are not only being exploited by the Saudi coalition to collectively punish the Yemeni people for resisting Saudi colonialism, but they are also based upon an illegitimate premise of a fugitive president who fled his own country and demanded the destruction of his own country. If we look at the fact that of those 27 million Yemenis, well over 60% now are on borderline of dying of starvation. Over 10,000 children in Yemen, and probably that number has increased tremendously by now, have died from treatable diseases. I will give you an instance of one young man who had a kidney transplant in 1998 at the age of 10. This transplant dramatically increased his quality of life during his childhood. 18 years later, in 2016, his transplanted kidney is being rejected by his body because the immunosuppressants are no longer available locally, nor can they be obtained via any traveler flying to Sana'a International Airport because the Saudi coalition has closed down the airport to incoming flights, which means that now there is no access to medicines for the Yemeni people who are being targeted on a daily basis by the Saudi coalition with an unbelievable number of illegal munitions, many of them supplied, of course, by the United States, who I believe since the beginning of the war, President Obama, until he left office, sold in the region of $33 billion worth of armaments to the Saudi coalition. The UK, around £3 billion. And France, a staggering $7.5 billion euros to Qatar, who is a member of the Saudi coalition. Among those munitions, of course, we find the US-supplied cluster bombs that were supplied by Textron or were manufactured by Textron in the United States until, I believe, May 2016. They claimed that they had stopped manufacture. But as far as we know, Saudi had a vast stock of these munitions as they are still being used. There were two recorded instances of cluster bomb usage in the last 2 weeks alone. And these munitions, these cluster munitions, are being used in contravention of the cluster bomb convention against civilian targets. We also know that United States and UK military advisors are present in the Riyadh Command and Control Center. And so they are clearly designating these civilian targets. So the United States' involvement on all levels across all organizations within the international community are responsible to a large extent for the suffering that the Yemeni people are undergoing. And another point to be made is that in the last few months, the Yemenis have yet again formed a coalition government that has been recognized under all Yemeni constitutional legal rights and was formed as an inclusive coalition government with Ali Abdullah Saleh's party, the GPC, and Ansarullah.
Thank you for that overview, Vanessa. I'm going to ask you for two short answers, if you would, please. What is the primary objective? What does Saudi Arabia get out of this? Since Yemen is a very poor country, it does not have the wealth of any of the other Arab states. And why would the United States support Saudi Arabia's clear and unequivocal war crimes against this country?
Well, I mean, I think I touched on the United States interests here in the sense that obviously if the Saudis were able to extract the oil from Yemen and to get it out of Yemen via the Gulf of Aden, that then reduces the risk of there being any blockages, particularly from Iran in the Straits of Hormuz. We also, you know, there is a connect between Saudi Arabia and Israel, in the sense that for both of them, their arch rival in the region or their nemesis in the region is Iran. And also, I strongly believe if we consider the fact that we know that Iran is a target for the United States, if we consider the fact that potentially al-Qaeda is being allowed to flourish inside Yemen, then of course Yemen is on Iran's doorstep, which potentially means there is a proxy army that is being incubated inside Yemen. Then if we also look at the fact that President Assad had the project of the five C's, which were basically the Mediterranean, the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, the Caspian Sea, and the Black Sea. The vision, of course, was to create a cooperative network of the various continents that surrounded these seas, and among those were Yemen. And so we see that with Syria very much at the center of this network, the heart of the arteries then spreading out in a cooperative network into Europe eventually. So of course this would mean the marginalization of United States hegemony in the region and the inclusion of Yemen into that cooperative, to a large extent, must not be allowed. And so therefore, what we're seeing is a targeting, effectively, of all nations that may have comprised that cooperative network, with Syria, of course, at the heart of that network. So there are, I believe, there are many connections here to what is happening in Syria, to what is happening in the region, to the security of Israel in the region. And if we come back to Yemen and look at it again, if we draw parallels here between the Israeli project in the Middle East, which is effectively to break down these resistant nations, these strong independent states, into partitioned mini states, partitioned along sectarian lines, that in fact was the project that President Mansour Hadi was about to put into was about to implement.
Vanessa, yes. I'd like to go to a little different direction now, because you've given us a pretty clear indication of what's happening with the Saudi Arabia needing the United States, supplying tens of billions of dollars to the United States in its military-industrial complex. But also, we should mention that Canada, France, Israel, and Turkey are also favorable towards the invasion. And now you've given us the idea that oil and gas and are the ultimate objects and the hegemony principle of Saudi Arabia in that area. And in my personal opinion, I believe that Saudi Arabia would like to see the complete extermination of the Yemeni people. In fact, the mainstream media in the United States has chosen not to do its homework to find out that about 1,000 Yemeni children are dying every week, or one every 10 minutes. And there are U.S. oil tankers off the coast for Saudi fighters jets to refuel at. Now let's shift gears over to Syria, because the American people have been brainwashed into believing that Assad was killing his own people during the Arab Spring. And therefore, just like with Libya and Gaddafi, the media only carried one side, as they did with Bush and Cheney in Iraq. One side. And that was that Assad had to go. He was a tyrant. He was using gas on his own civilians. And as a result, several nations became involved, not the least of which was the United States and also Saudi Arabia and Turkey. But you have been there. You have seen the contradictions between the official mainstream media reports and your own observations and interviews as a respected journalist, to see what did the actual people of Syria have to say. What are the facts that we know? Like Seymour Hersh did the reporting show that it was not Assad using gas on his own people, but rather it was the so-called moderate terrorist. I guess a moderate terrorist is a person that will behead you but not crucify you. Saudi Arabia has this habit of beheading you and crucifying you, as if somehow death becomes redundant in that simpleton country. So I'd like for you to talk about your experiences, and at the same time, remind us of the American media, including Democracy Now! And other programs on the left that supported and praised the invasions of these countries, but also supported the White Helmets, and they just won an Academy Award. I would like to think this is done out of simple ignorance and laziness of not looking deep enough for the facts. You've been there. You've seen the truth. Now, please share the truth about your experiences with the people of Syria, the battle for Syria, and the fact that if Russia had not engaged, then today the likely outcome would be we would have a state of Syria very similar to the state of Libya, a completely failed state where multiple terrorist groups would be thriving and make cutting a deal probably with Turkey and Israel to get the oil, which has a very high quality light crude, on the black market, as Turkey was doing. And also, just as an aside, this is what's amazing. We have all these people who are claiming to have knowledge, none of whom are ever questioned when they go on any MSNBC or Fox or CNN about a question. How much money do you make for consulting or as a lobbyist for any military-industrial complex? Who do you work with? How much do you make? And then that should be considered in taking anything that you say as objective. Where's the veracity of someone who is paid to go on and has a media company to get you on as the so-called expert? So we never hear from any progressives. So on the one hand, we know for a fact that Erdogan in Turkey and his son were allowing massive transport, thousands, over 12,000 tanker trucks to go from Turkey without ever being stopped through Turkish checkpoints into Syria, take the oil, bring it back in, go into Iraq, take the oil, come back into Syria, or Turkey. That oil was then sold for as little as $20 a barrel, much of it going to Israel and other countries, that money being kept by Erdogan's son with some kickback to ISIS, and therefore ISIS had millions of dollars a week to work with. They had hospitals set up, training sessions set up, financing in Turkey for ISIS and al-Nusra. Saudi Arabia did the same thing. We have absolute proof of this. And in fact, in even Hillary Clinton's emails that were released, given over by WikiLeaks, we have her acknowledging that these are supporting terrorism. So on the one hand, you have Donald Trump saying that we want to deal with ISIS, but of all the countries that are primarily responsible for terrorism, the ones that are not there are the primary ones: Turkey and Saudi Arabia, Qatar and United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain. So he excludes all the countries that are funding, training, supporting terrorists, and goes after the countries like Syria that are not. And I don't believe that Trump can be that functionally illiterate. I do believe that he is extremely limited intellectually, probably at about a 13-year-old male construct of the world, and is hence heavily influenced by people who give him input. But the media does not ever challenge this. I'd like for you to challenge all the above for us. The forum is yours.
Thank you. Well, coming to the conflict in Syria, which right from the beginning, I mean, going back as far as 2006 and probably even before, we've seen actually a series of interventions in Syria back as far as 1949, 1957, coming through to the 80s, and then obviously leading up to 2011. And as I say, that had been prefabricated back as far as 2006. And that is very extensively documented. If we look at the myth that President Assad, or that the Syrian government, the Syrian state, and the Syrian National Army is targeting its own civilians, this is immediately put into the mythical department by the fact that those civilians, 80% of whom are inside government-held areas within Syria, even those that are displaced, which I think are now, we have figures for around 6.3 million that are internally displaced, have fled to those government-held areas. So basically, within Syria, the territory that is held by the Syrian government and by the Syrian army, and obviously then alongside its allies in this war, the majority of civilians are within those areas for their own protection. So that belies this image that people have that the Syrian government is attacking and targeting its own civilians. And this, you know, again, I'll come back to my time that I spent in Aleppo, where we saw very clearly that when these various NATO and Gulf state-funded militant terrorist and extremist factions were finally driven out of East Aleppo, where, as you had quite rightly said in the introduction, they had incarcerated, imprisoned, tortured, executed, and deprived the real Syrian civilians, around 110,000 of them, for almost 5 years. When we saw those terrorist and militant factions driven out of East Aleppo, what did we see? We didn't see those civilians fleeing with those terrorist factions, who were, of course, described by corporate media as moderate rebels or at best, armed opposition. No, we saw those 110,000 civilians head into West Aleppo, which was the government-held area of Aleppo. And we then saw those civilians returning to their homes in East Aleppo after the Russian sappers had cleared thousands of hectares of mines and IEDs and booby traps that had been left behind by the departing various militant factions, terrorist factions, who, by the way, were allowed to leave peacefully underneath the Syrian government Amnesty and Reconciliation Program. So they were allowed to leave and head to Idlib. Those civilians who were then reunited with their families in West Aleppo got on with their lives. And very clearly, we noticed that there is now no corporate media in Aleppo to report upon the fact that Aleppo is rebuilding without the humanitarian siege, without the occupation by the United States, NATO, and Gulf state-funded militant factions. So we see very clearly that once the terrorism is removed from the situation, how the Syrian people react. Do they flee their government? Do they flee their army? No, the absolute opposite. They actually welcome them in, and they then get on with their lives. They get on with the rebuilding, and they get on with restructuring their lives after its devastation that was brought on by that terrorist occupation, which was imposed upon them by our regimes in the West. So very clearly we see straight away that there is very little veracity, the reports in corporate media, not only in corporate media, in the NATO-aligned NGOs, the NGO complex, the smart power complex, or the soft power complex, and even in the UN, who have equally exacerbated the myth of the Syrian government attacking its own people. And then when we come to the chemical weapon attacks, if again we look at Aleppo and we look at the claims, there was a very recent Human Rights Watch report that came out on the 17th of February this year, almost a retrospective of the chemical weapon attacks in Aleppo, based yet again upon pretty much anonymous witness statements and testimony from inside East Aleppo, which we know now was predominantly governed and occupied by militant and extremist and terrorist factions. Over 22 brigades of these various factions that splinter off wherever they are and fight amongst themselves. But we know that the majority of the chemical attacks were actually carried out by those terrorist factions. Nusra Front took over the only chemical factory in East Aleppo in 2012. But we also know from prior to that, from various redacted documents, that Bellingcat, Elliot Higgins, was informed by another CIA operative on the ground, Matthew Van Dyke, that the rebels, as they were then euphemistically called, had access to chemical weapons even prior to the Ghouta attacks in 2013, the alleged attacks. If we then look at, in fact, I was watching something about this today. If we look at in 2013, the initial attack in March 2013 in Khan al-Asul, which was near Aleppo, in which a number of Syrian Arab Army soldiers were killed by a chemical attack carried out by one of the terrorist factions in the country. A report was put into the United Nations, and it took the United Nations 4 months, 11 days to send an investigative team to Damascus to look into this incident. And extraordinarily, on the day they arrived, the day after, there was a chemical weapons attack in the suburbs or in the countryside of Damascus, which immediately should draw a suspicion as to why on earth would the Syrian government use chemical weapons when the chemical weapon inspectors have just arrived in the country to investigate a prior terrorist attack against their own national army. So the chemical weapon stories have yet again predominantly been discredited. The majority of them, interestingly, have come from the organization that you mentioned, the Syria Civil Defense, as they fraudulently call themselves. Why do I say that is fraudulent? Because there is an existing Syria Civil Defense, the real Syria Civil Defense, that was established in 1953 inside Syria, unlike the White Helmets that was established outside Syria in Turkey by a British ex-military mercenary. And the White Helmets are used to manufacture a lot of the propaganda that emanates from Syria in order to feed the regime change agenda of our governments and their allied corporate media and, as I said, their soft power NGOs. There was a report that actually came out today that has denounced the White Helmet evidence of another chemical attack in Sarmin in March 2015. Now, this attack basically, in theory, reduced the United Nations to tears. It again facilitated the various calls for a no-fly zone, which we know is effectively a declaration of war or an escalation of the conflict between the United States and Russia on Syrian soil. And today, the Swedish Doctors for Human Rights have actually put out a statement and a report denouncing the White Helmets video that was used for that UN report, stating that in this video, they have witnessed macabre manipulation of dead children and staged chemical weapons attacks to facilitate a no-fly zone in Syria. So this is a very important document that has been put out by the Swedish Doctors for Human Rights, in which they describe the malpractice that is carried out either by the White Helmet medics themselves or by the medics that they are filming. It is very clear from the translation of that video that there is a huge amount of posturing and arranging of the bodies within the video in order to produce the right effect, the right propaganda effect. So this investigation is very important, but it's one of many that have exposed the White Helmets as a NATO and Gulf state shadow state construct designed to mimic the real Syria civil defense, the Syrian institution, state institution, NGO that is working to serve the people, the real people of Syria inside Syria, demonstrating that this organization, the White Helmets, are working exclusively alongside Nusra Front and ISIS and various other terrorist and militant factions inside Syria. Myself, when I went into East Aleppo and I followed in the tracks of the Syrian Arab Army, speaking to the civilians who were emerging from their five-year incarceration, when I asked them if they knew of the White Helmets, the majority, in fact, almost universally, they said to me, yes, they were Nusra Front civil defense. So very clearly, we see that this organization is affiliated to the extremist factions who are also funded, armed, and equipped by our governments. So we see really the two sides of one coin. On one, we see the terrorists, and on the other, we see the soft power, the humanitarian first responders who are used as an umbrella to cover the crimes of the various terrorist factions inside Syria, not only to cover them, but also to facilitate them, and in many cases, to participate in them. So the White Helmets have been really extensively discredited as a humanitarian organization and have been exposed to be affiliated to the terrorists, working with them to produce the propaganda that enables the continuation of the regime change war inside Syria being waged against Syria.
Vanessa, there's also just the element of common sense. In every one of the operational theaters where al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, ISIS has been operating, anyone who represents a member of any Red Cross or any of the doctors helping, they're always assassinated. They're generally taken hostage. They're used to either for extortion. But money has not been the object because they've had plenty of money and they have plenty of equipment. And much of the equipment that we're now seeing that the terrorists throughout the Middle East are using were made in the USA. And so you do not dare be in a facility where you have these groups, because everywhere where they leave a community, they generally kill as many people as they can. They rape the women. They take the younger girls for their wives or for sex trade. And no one who is not a part of them is left untouched. So are you going to tell me that a group of White Helmets was able to work day in, day out for years, hand in hand with al-Nusra and with these terrorist groups, and not ever be attacked, assassinated, held hostage? It just defies common sense. But then in the American media does nothing when it comes to common sense or reason. They do not do the homework. They're not on the ground like you are. And they're still demonizing Assad. In the last study I saw, Assad was loved by them and supported by the majority of the people of Syria.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that is still 100% the case. If you go to Syria, you will hear time and time again that even the unarmed opposition, even those who wanted reforms back in 2011 but felt that they were achieving a large number of those reforms before the reformist movement was hijacked. I don't call it a revolution. I don't even call it an uprising, because it really wasn't. It was just demonstrations in order to perhaps push the government to accelerate reforms from the government, which was happening. And it, again, you made the very good point. And what we see, again, if we look at East Aleppo, did we see the White Helmets stay behind to help the civilians that were emerging in an emaciated, often wounded, damaged state from that 4.5 year incarceration? No, they left in tandem with the various terrorist and militant factions, all of them. And that is what we've seen, where the White Helmets are embedded. And if that area is liberated, we don't see the White Helmets stay behind to help the civilians. We see them leaving with the terrorist factions who have been perpetrating the crimes and atrocities against those civilians. So, yes, it's very clear that they are working hand in hand with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS, with Al-Asham, with Nour al-Din Zinki, the beheaders of the 12-year-old Palestinian child. And coming back to the real Syria civil defense, one of the accusations, or certainly one of the claims that the White Helmets make, is that, oh, well, yes, but we're helping the civilians in the areas that can't be covered by the real Syria civil defense, because they only stay in the government-held areas. Well, as I've just demonstrated, the government-held areas house probably about, conservatively speaking, and this is confirmed by the United Nations, around 80% of the remaining population inside Syria, so around 15 to 16 million people. So the real Syria civil defense is actually servicing the huge bulk, the 80-20 rule. They're servicing 80% of that population. The remaining 20%, the majority of whom are in areas that are being occupied and brutalized by these various terrorist factions, they're not being serviced by the White Helmets, because we hear from East Aleppo that the White Helmets are working only for Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda. So this entire myth, as you quite rightly say, is based upon very puerile, very facile claims that are relatively easy to break down and expose to be the fraudulent claims that they are, by going to Syria, by actually witnessing the situation on the ground, which the majority of our corporate media simply don't do. What they do is, again, as you mentioned, the term embedding, what they do is embed trained citizen journalists, activists, who we see yet again. When areas are liberated, do we see them stay behind? No. We see them exit with the various terrorist factions. And it is those militant affiliated activists that are being constantly platformed by our corporate media, by CNN, by the BBC, by Channel 4 in the UK, by all of the media outlets. All we are receiving, the only people we receive news from, are effectively Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Vanessa, I'm going to have just a few closing thoughts here. We must also consider the following, and this is something I have an intimate knowledge of, as I've been working to help Syrian refugees with a group of doctors and nutritionists out of Australia for several months. Still in the process of doing that, by the way. And what we're finding is, of the several million refugees from Libya and Syria, but also from Africa, that went into Europe, mainly through Greece and then on to Italy and clear up to Norway and Sweden and Germany, that the ones who seem to be best at assimilating are the people from Syria. They have a high level of education, and the ones least able to assimilate culturally are many of the ones who, mainly many of the males, who are coming from other countries but not Syria. And no one makes that distinction. But you will find that distinction when you speak with people and activists and people in other countries who are working with the immigrants, trying to get them to assimilate and so they can have a quality of life until they're able, hopefully, to return to their countries if things change. Now, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, all of those, including Turkey. Turkey has taken some refugees, but the rest have not taken a single person. And yet Saudi Arabia has the largest immigration camp in the world. It is not just a bunch of tents. There's air conditioning. There's water. There's not a single person. Japan has taken none. So some of the people, exclude Japan for a moment, but take the people who have caused the problem, should not they be responsible for handling the refugees, not soldiers, refugees, from the very countries that they were responsible in destroying? And there's been no media talking about why they don't have a moral obligation. You bomb this country, you created these refugees, you have starving children, take them in, help them. The answer is no. No in every one of these countries. And so they end up going to countries, some of which these countries did not participate in causing these people's suffering, and some did. United Kingdom did. France did. They should be held responsible. So we're not even looking at the totality of cause and effect. We're not looking at the ultimate outcome. We're not looking at, it's not the religion that causes someone not to assimilate. It's the culture. And therefore, trying to understand other countries and people's culture to see what you can do to make a transition so you do not put people at loggerhead when it comes to being able to assimilate. And so that's part of the issue that I'm seeing. I'm just seeing the inequality in how we're approaching the entire refugee problem at this time. And I see Turkey is responsible, Saudi Arabia is chiefly responsible. I see all the most of the Emirate countries responsible, the United States behind all of it. And behind all this, I see a group of people who, in every situation, they're the ones responsible for the people in power to say, yes, we will contribute this, yes, we will do that. And they're removed. They have plausible deniability. We don't see them. We don't hear their names. They are not front and center. And yet they are the deep state. They are the hidden hand behind all this. And sooner or later, they will be exposed. I want to thank you for your good work. I look forward to having you back because I believe that you have a great deal to share about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what you see as the progenitors and solutions that are possible. So that will be our next conversation. Vanessa Beley, B-E-L-E-Y. You can reach her at thewallwillfall.org and 21stcenturywire.com. I'm Gary Nall for a special edition of the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening. Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry.